To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA.
Can you send an officer to Motel 15?
Calling for help. For victims of violence, it's often hard to know who to turn to. And then there's the cycle of fear.
And he started shaking me. And I felt like a wreck dog because I heard my daughter saying, "Mommy, Mommy."
On this week's program, defending victims by prosecuting their attackers, whether they're victims of hate crimes in Long Island or domestic violence in El Paso.
I think domestic violence is an important issue because they're just little murders. If we don't do something now, it's going to turn into something worse.
And from the plains of Colombia to the streets of New York City, the music of jazz harpist Edmar Castañeda. Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Joining me to discuss the news this week is Frank Contreras, a reporter based in Mexico City and a longtime contributor to Latino USA. Thanks for joining us on Latino USA again, Frank.
Good to be with you again.
So this week we want to focus our week in review on recent developments in Mexico's drug war. Frank, despite all of the measures taken by Mexico's President Felipe Calderón, the situation remains dire. In December of 2006, Calderón deployed army troops and federal police to key points around the country to stem the violence. And even this year, he sent an additional 10,000 troops to Ciudad Juarez, where the tensions have been highest and crime rates and murders continue to climb. So at this point, is there any end in sight? Perhaps if you don't talk nationally, is there any end in sight for these particular communities that are so battered by crime and violence?
Well, Maria, if you listen to the Mexican government and President Felipe Calderón, there's definitely an end in sight. He explains that he'll be doing away with drug violence before his presidency ends. But he cannot convince his own people of that. That's because since Calderón took office in December 2006, more than 14,000 people have been killed in Mexico in drug-related violence. We're even starting to see politicians being targeted here. In the first weekend of September, a politician in the Gulf Coast state of Tabasco was caught by a cartel known as the Zetas, the Gulf Cartel, and they cut his head off. Then they murdered his wife. So it seems like there's no end in sight to these killings. And in fact, they might even be getting more and more gruesome.
Yeah, no, it's so shocking to hear this kind of stuff, Frank. It's, I mean, while not everybody is living in this kind of terror, the fact is that this kind of violence has become somewhat commonplace. But let's talk about the fact that this week, the Attorney General, Eduardo Medina Mora, resigned from his post. He was a key figure in leading the government's efforts against the cartels. He was a close ally of President Calderón. So what is the story? Why did he resign? And do you think his replacement will be able to carry on his policies?
Over this summer, as you know, Maria, Calderón's party lost control of the lower house of Congress, the National Congress here. And basically, that ended up doing away with Calderón's ability to pass some of his key reforms. And so what he's trying to do now is show Mexicans that he's got a new brand of leadership, that he's going to take on all sort of new fronts. And even the point man on the war on drugs has been changed out. There's going to be a new man heading that up. He will be the person who is in charge of the federal government, the justice system, covering the state of Chihuahua, where Ciudad Juarez is located.
Is there any sense that Felipe Calderón can, in fact, figure a way out of this if you've got the numbers of troops, the number of federal police, the increasing violence, and the kind of violence? Is there any kind of sense among the population that Felipe Calderón can actually have an impact?
There's absolutely no sense of that at all here in Mexico. Just about anyone I talk to anywhere in the country is convinced that the president cannot win this war on drugs. Why? Because the demand in the United States continues to grow, not only in the United States, but also here in Mexico. We have seen since the year 2002, Maria, a 50% growth in drug addictions in Mexico alone. And Mexico is becoming an exporting point for drugs that go off to Europe and to Asia and even to Africa. So Mexico has become a key transshipment point for international drug trades. And so that's one of the main reasons. Also, If you look at the best example possible, really, the city of Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, just south of El Paso, Texas, as you mentioned earlier, this city had seen a tremendous amount of violence 2 years running, and the president has sent at least two waves now, thousands and thousands of soldiers. You can see the place, and pretty much on a daily basis, you get a sense that Ciudad Juarez is militarized. And what has happened there? Well, in August alone, we saw more than 360 murders, drug-related murders in Ciudad Juarez, breaking yet another record. And so there's no indication that a strong military presence in a border city like that can bring an end to the violence. And so that starts to raise questions. Can we see an end to the violence in other parts of Mexico? And it seems to be that the answer is no. What we are seeing, in fact, is that the criminal organizations are expanding beyond drug trafficking and spreading into a wide array of at least 25 other types of crimes, Maria. They're now involved in kidnappings, car thefts, they steal people's homes. So it seems at this stage that it's going to be an absolutely difficult task for the president to achieve his promise and bring an end to the violence related to drug trafficking.
Thanks, Frank, for that update.
Thanks, Maria.
Frank Contreras is a radio and television reporter based in Mexico City. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In November of 2008, an Ecuadorian immigrant named Marcelo Lucero was murdered in the town of Patchogue, New York. The police say the killing was carried out by a gang of teenagers who called themselves the Caucasian Crew. They targeted Latino residents as part of a gruesome sport they called beaner hopping. The death of Marcelo Lucero garnered headlines across the country. Now, almost a year later, it's the stepping stone point for a comprehensive report on anti-Latino violence in Suffolk County, New York, undertaken by the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's called Climate of Fear, and its editor is Mark Potok, who joins me now from Washington, D.C. Mark, welcome back to Latino USA. Your report is really sobering, to say the least. You have identified a number of factors in anti-Latino violence, so many that we don't even have time to go through all of them. So I'm wondering if we can focus on a few. I'm quoting here from the report. It says, there is abundant evidence that Suffolk County officials have contributed to an atmosphere conducive to racial violence. You refer to County Executive Steve Levy as an enabler. So what is the evidence that political rhetoric can be deadly?
Well, just to sketch it out very briefly, really what happened in Suffolk County was a little over 10 years ago, a local group called Sachem Quality of Life was started. It became a very virulent anti-immigration group. It brought, among others, white supremacist speakers in to talk about the evils of people with brown skin and so on. We did focus heavily on the role of the politicians, and what we found was essentially that not all, but many of the leading politicians in Suffolk County did not try and cool the flames or sort of lead the community to a better place where it could have a rational discussion of immigration and its consequences, but did quite the opposite. So we had, for instance, one Suffolk County legislator say at one point several years ago, if they come to my town, we'll be out with baseball bats. Another legislator from the county said, you know, if day laborers were to appear on my corner and gathering on my corner, I would load my gun and start shooting. Another interrupted a couple of Spanish speakers at a hearing on all this immigration trouble there and told them that if they were illegal, they and their friends better beware. Steve Levy, who is the county executive, the highest elected official in Suffolk County, didn't talk about loading guns and shooting people or baseball bats, but he worked very much against the interests of immigrants repeatedly on a whole array of actions.
So essentially, if you're talking about Suffolk County, are you saying that hate-motivated crimes are essentially not taken seriously?
Well, I don't think I could fairly say that they're not being taken seriously at all anymore. There's been a great deal of attention put on Suffolk since the murder of Marcelo Lucero, And a lot of the, certainly the police departments have been working quite hard to make real connections with the immigrant community. I think what really happened in Suffolk was the indifference or even hostility of elected officials essentially trickled down into the police departments to the point, which isn't to say that people were simply sloughed off, but if it were a hate crime attack, for instance, in many cases, immigrants reported at least being told, you know, no reason to write this up as a hate crime, this was a robbery, that kind of thing. So in other words, a kind of effort to diminish perhaps the bad PR aspects of this.
Mark Potok, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA, and thanks for the work you do.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mark Potok is the director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. You can read the entire report, Climate of Fear, Latino Immigrants in Suffolk County, New York, on our website, latinousa.org. According to the National Institute of Justice, one in four women will experience domestic violence in her lifetime. It's a crime that often goes unreported, and when it does, prosecution is not easy. But in El Paso, Texas, the district attorney's office has launched a new initiative, sending teams to investigate reports of domestic violence within 24 hours of their occurrence. Thanks to the new initiative, prosecutors have much stronger cases against violators, and survivors of domestic violence can get a lot of help faster. From El Paso, Monica Ortiz Uribe has our story.
Joe McBain and his partner, Tina Butler, witness suffering on a daily basis. Tearful stories, bruised lips, broken homes. McBain is an investigator for the El Paso District Attorney's Office Domestic Violence Unit. Butler is a victim's advocate. Every day, their mission is to keep survivors of domestic violence safe and go after the bad guy. On a recent Monday, the duo had 11 of those missions to pursue.
And it was a dispatch, 911, it was a hang-up. And it's a drinking case. And he's choking the CW. He's got one more month to do something like that again before it becomes a felony.
Butler highlights details off a police report to McBain as they drive through a northeast El Paso neighborhood formerly known as the Devil's Triangle for its high crime rate.
Oh, there are children involved as well. The children saw it. They listed their ages 4, 3, and 2.
McBain and Butler are one of two teams that hit the streets of El Paso 5 days a week to do home visits with domestic violence victims. Their efforts are part of a new initiative by the DA's office in which an investigator and a victim's advocate must visit the survivor of an assault within 24 hours.
If we wait much longer than that, then I'm not sure we always get an accurate picture of what happens, because then people start to settle in and they start to take sides instead of just recounting for us what happened.
Jaime Esparza is the district attorney for El Paso, a post he's held for the last 17 years. Since the initiative began a year ago, Esparza's office has reviewed more than 1,800 domestic violence cases.
I think domestic violence is an important issue because in a lot of ways, they're just little murders. If we don't do something now, if we don't do it up front, it's going to turn into something worse.
Back on the streets, investigator Joe McBain and his partner Tina Butler arrive at the home of a woman who accused her husband of choking her the night before.
Hi.
The woman answers the door barefoot, wearing shorts and a faded gray army t-shirt. She escorts her guests into the living room where three foggy saltwater aquariums emit a deceiving air of tranquility. Hanging on the walls are photos of the woman and her husband smiling together. The photos seem grossly out of place as the woman recounts the attack.
Let my body fall down to the floor so my knees hit the floor and then he got my hair and he started shaking me and I felt like a rag doll. My body and my head were, it felt like they were going in two different directions. I heard my daughter saying, "Mommy, Mommy."
During a home visit, the investigator and the victim's advocate record the victim's testimony and take photos of any injury the victim may have suffered. The evidence gathered during home visits is reviewed by the domestic violence unit back at the DA's office.
We're going to go through every case individually and to determine what the recommendation should be for the plea of guilty, if you were to plead guilty. So we follow,
in a long conference room, prosecutors, staff, and a representative from a local battered women's shelter sit for a meeting that will go for at least a couple of hours. At the head of the room, a large screen displays information pertinent to the cases that happened the day before, including criminal histories, mugshots, crime scene photos, and photos of the victim's injuries. District Attorney Jaime Esparza is present at these meetings, which are held four times a week. Esparza reviews the cases and makes a recommendation on the charges and the punishment for the prosecution. Thanks to the new initiative, Esparza said his office gathers more evidence faster, which makes for a stronger case in court.
So the prosecutor has available to him all the tools necessary to what we think would make a successful prosecution.
Esparza's office has applied for a grant through the Texas Governor's Office for funds to cover home visits over the weekend. If the grant goes through, the University of Texas at Austin will study the El Paso DA's 24-hour domestic violence initiative. The study will determine if the program is resulting in more successful prosecutions and whether other prosecutors around the country can benefit from the model. For Latino USA, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe in El Paso.
And now let's move on to the Supreme Court. Of course, Sonia Sotomayor is much more than simply a wise Latina, as this label became a point of contention in her confirmation hearings. But as commentator Michelle Garcia says, the focus on Sotomayor's wise Latina remark missed a lot more than the context under which it was first uttered.
If you followed the news reports, the commentators, the chatterati, you probably didn't learn much more about her. Not much more about her writings than that wise Latina comment without context. Or why having a Latina on the Supreme Court really matters. Missing from the public debates was a discussion about how Latinos have shaped and formed U.S. law. Laws reflect the values and perspectives of who we are. It reflects the fits and twists of a society constantly changing. In the writings of Sonia Sotomayor, we see glimmers of a perspective unique to the Latino experience. In law school, Sotomayor wrote at the conclusion of a Yale Law Review article, "The American experience with colonialism in the early half of this century has left the United States responsible for several small, economically poor dependencies." And with that, Sotomayor fused the Latino and American experience with colonialism, one that she is intimately acquainted with. Not just through books, but from the life story of her parents and ancestors from an island that went from Spanish colonialism to U.S. imperialism. It's a perspective in this nation unique to Latinos, descendants of the conquistadores and of the conquered. But that didn't get talked about. And for once, I didn't write an article to explore the missing parts. The need was greater. And so last month, an attorney, a sociologist, a law professor, and myself organized a small symposium to talk about the issues that didn't get talked about. It was at New York University's law school. And what came from it? We learned that law schools filter constitutional law through an archaic black and white racial paradigm that Latinos do not neatly fit into. That when you look closely, you see Latinos in key desegregation cases, one that led to the Brown versus Board of Education ruling. That the Hano lawyers had to explain to the justices at the Supreme Court who Latinos were, and that was just 50 years ago. And from that symposium came a manifesto. We signed our names to it and committed ourselves to the work that lies ahead, sharing and informing others about the role of Latinos in shaping U.S. law, U.S. justice, to speak what could not or would not be said, so that the next time we talk about one Latino, there's a better sense of what he or she is said to represent. For Latinos, for all of us.
Michelle Garcia is a producer for Independent Sources, a public television program covering the media in New York City. You can read a copy of The Collective's Manifesto at latinousa.org. In a minute, desde los llanos hasta las calles de Nueva York, music from harpist Edmar Castañeda, coming up on Latino USA. Quédense con nosotros. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision.
and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. From the plains of Colombia, the musical stylings of joropo have easily defined that South American nation with its use of guitars, maracas, and most importantly, the harp. Harpist and composer Edmar Castañeda grew up with that tradition, yet he's been quick to set himself apart by combining the folkloric music with the upbeat rhythms of Latin jazz. Since moving to the United States in 1994, Castañeda has performed with numerous greats, including Chico O'Farrell, and he's made a name for himself by exploring new directions in jazz. His latest album is called Entre Cuerdas, and he joins me now in New York City. Welcome to Latino USA, Edmar.
Thank you.
All right, so harp, really big instrument, and you're really small. Like me. I was like, wait a second, because on your CD cover, it looks like you're carrying the harp. What drew you to this instrument? Was it growing up in Colombia and seeing that the harp is kind of played all the time? What was it for you?
Yeah, I started as a dancer in Colombia when I was 7 years old with folk music, música llanera, music from the plains of Colombia and Venezuela. Then the harp is the main instrument of that music. So that's when I saw it, and I was like, wow, that instrument has a lot of strings, you know? And then I started at 13 playing the harp.
There's something that you do. I think the entire CD is really surprising. You don't immediately think of the harp and jazz, and yet you've really made it flow. When did you decide that you wanted to kind of go in that direction of not traditional, but really pushing the boundaries?
I started as a traditional, learning traditional music. When I got to this country, I met jazz, you know, for the first time. And I was like, wow, this music is great, you know. And then I went to college and I studied trumpet because they didn't have harp, you know. So I learned all the elements of jazz and just apply on the harp with my Latin flavor.
One song that I really loved is called Colibri. Uh-huh. Happens to be that I love the colibri. So for those of you who don't know, a colibri is a hummingbird. And in this song, you really get that sense of, you know, the fast-paced kind of staccato way of the hummingbird. But I wonder what it's like to play the harp with that kind of speed and precision.
I don't know, I really like tradition. It has a lot of influence from llanera music, and it also has influence from flamenco, bulería. That song has those two parts. They are very similar to llanera music. And then it's just that Colombian, llanera music has a lot of, you play fast and really percussive and aggressive way. So I wrote that tune, you know, trying to imitate the bird in the beginning and then just go more flamenco, more strong, and then really fun. And I actually, in that tune was a great vibraphone player, Joe Lack, as a guest.
You're the leader of the Edmar Castañeda Trio now, and that includes you, a trombone player and a drummer. And in many ways, the harp can cover the sounds of many instruments. You can play bass, you can play, you know, make it kind of like a percussive instrument. So when you're putting together this trio, how did you decide the instruments that you wanted to include?
Yes, first of all, what I do on the harp is it's like two instruments in one. At the same time, you play the bass lines and like a piano on the other hand. So it sounds like two instruments in one. And then when I decide to put this trio together, the trombone is not a usual instrument either. So it's
not
balanced.
For a trio, no.
Now with the harp and trombone, it's like, wow.
And when you came to New York and you had that first experience with jazz, what was that like? Because it's true. I mean, in Colombia, it's not like you can kind of go out on every night and see a bunch of different jazz groups playing. I mean, certainly in Bogota, there's a jazz scene. But the jazz scene here in New York, what did that do to you as a musician?
It was like, wow, this music, you can improvise, you can play what you feel. So that I really like that part of that music. And that's like, it's in Colombia, like the traditional llanera music, you improvise a lot.
Oh, really?
So it was a great connection there.
I didn't realize that in the llaneras, you improvise.
Yeah, a lot. You know, you just improvise and follow the singer. And then after that, you, in the middle, you just improvise and play what you feel. So it's like jazz, but in Colombia.
Where do you most enjoy playing? Is it when you go back to Colombia and, you know, people kind of say, wow, what did Edmar do to the llaneras? Is that the funnest part, or is it going to places where maybe they've never heard this kind of music?
I think anywhere that, you know, you go, it's really special. We just came, like, for a month of tour in Europe. You know, people haven't seen the instrument applying in this kind of music, so it's really great to see people how they react, and you know, they say, wow, you can groove on the harp.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA and for bringing this very particular sound to the world. Thank you, Edmar.
Thank you very much.
Edmar Castañeda's newest album, Entre Cuerdas, is available through edmarcastañeda.com. For more information, check our own website at latinousa.org. And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. Latino USA is produced by Walter Morgan, Mincho Jacob, Angela Maldonado, Alex Avila, and Katie Davis. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. Our listener comment line is 800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. You can visit us online anytime at latinousa.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by Frederica and Howard Stevenson, helping low-income students access education through the Summer Search Foundation at summersearch.org. By Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring. Catalog at lumberliquidators.com. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.